This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the proposition America is too damn religious. The live event took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of February 7, 2007. It was sponsored by the Rosenkranz Foundation. The event was moderated by Peter Steinfels, who writes the New York Times Beliefs column. The audience was polled before and after the event. The entry poll gauged the live audience as firmly in agreement with the motion, America is too damn religious. 67% voted in favor, while only 24% voted against. 9% didn't know. At these debates, the moderator sits in the center of a long table with three debaters for the motion to his right and three against to his left. The evening features an 8-minute opening statement from each panelist, a question and answer period, and closing statements. This radio program features only excerpts of the live event. You can listen to the full unedited debate at npr.org/intelligencesquared. We'll begin with the Reverend Barry W. Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, arguing in favor of the motion, America is too damn religious.
Now, what is it? Why is it that a church-going, Jesus-accepting member of the Christian clergy is on this side of the platform tonight? And the answer really lies in the very carefully worded proposition that is under debate this evening, that America is too damn religious. I don't think there is too much religion in America, although my own colleagues actually might disagree with that. But I clearly think there's too much of the damnable kind. What is a damn religion? Damn religion is a religion so weak-willed and unsure of its own capacity to persuade others to support it or live by its guidance that it seeks the blessing of government, that it seeks financial aid from government, and that it even tries to convert its theological beliefs into legislative fiats. This damn form of religion is a corruption both of faith and of constitutional democracy, and it makes a mockery of the best in our history. It was the 5th United States Congress that unanimously approved the Treaty of Tripoli, which unequivocally stated that this was in no way founded as a Christian nation. Thomas Jefferson refused to sign proclamations of prayer or resolutions of thanksgiving, believing, how shocking is this, that it should be religious bodies, not governmental ones, that decided what days should bring forth the greatest prayer from the American people. Indeed, throughout most of our American history, we've been moving toward a greater embrace of religious diversity, a greater rejection of the idea that government, federal or state, should pick favorites among religions or choose religion over non-religion. By 1960, then-presidential aspirant John F. Kennedy addressed a meeting of Southern Baptists concerned about his allegiances as a Roman Catholic to declare, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute." But what a difference a few decades can make. Now politicians see as much advantage in pandering to religion as embarrassingly religion seems to gain or try to gain by seeking the assistance of government. So it's a dual corruption, tainting the secular nature of our government and making religious groups special interest supplicants at what is often a quite odoriferous public trough. So let me just briefly go into these specifics in these minutes remaining of how this unholy matrimony kind of plays out in the 21st century. First, religious groups too often, if you will, seek the blessing of government. A few examples. Now we see public spaces increasingly festooned with more and more religious icons and images, monuments, and scriptural citations, almost always at the behest of the currently statistically most popular religion in America, Christianity. After every major school shooting in the United States, members of Congress insisted if we posted the Ten Commandments on every schoolroom wall, we would stop the next violent student uprising from occurring. They're never willing to talk about gun control. They're never willing to even talk about spending money to work with at-risk young people, but Decalogue display is the panacea. But you know, if proximity to holy words really made us better people, then the presence of Gideon Bibles in nightstands at motels would have ended adultery long ago, and it has not. It is not that simple. Now, second, dissatisfied with some powerful symbolic support, some groups even go further and actually want to receive from the public treasury, the tax dollars of all of us, funding. President Bush likes this idea. He created an Office of Faith-Based Initiatives back in 2001 to get more money for what he called the armies of compassion around America who cared for the poor, the hungry, and the homeless. He told an audience in New Orleans just 1 year before he forgot that the city existed that he saw his program as one that would give funds to groups that are saving Americans one soul at a time, once again confusing his role as commander-in-chief with that of theologian-in-chief. The final characteristic of damn religion is the most pernicious. That's where religious groups decide that because they are sure that they have a biblical understanding of an issue, say the right of reproductive choice, no one will be dared to have another opinion and act on it. That's why they seek things like constitutional amendments to prohibit all abortion. I know that there are people on the other side of this debate who will say, but there is great evidence of progressive thinking in churches now and in the past, and obviously that's true. But I remind you that Dr. Martin Luther King never endorsed a single candidate from any pulpit in America. He knew that the long arc of justice would reach its goal only when all Americans, black and white, young and old, believer and non-believer, would count on the Constitution as the last great protector of the rights of the people. That's the faith that ought to guide religion in America, but regrettably, it's the damn kind that seems to get all the attention and have all the clout today. And luckily, because I am not running for any elective office, I do not have to say at the end of this small speech, God bless America.
The first speaker against the motion, America is too damn religious, is professor of social and political ethics at the University of Chicago, Jean Bethke-Elstein.
America is too damn religious, says who? We could ask our greatest presidential theologian, Abraham Lincoln, who references God 14 times in the four paragraphs of his masterpiece of American political rhetoric, the second inaugural address. We could ask Martin Luther King, with the rhythms and cadences and words of scripture flowing eloquently in his powerful civic sermons. As you listen to that remarkable voice intoning the words of the prophet Amos, let justice roll down like a mighty river. You close your eyes and mutter, amen, brother, amen. King certainly worked to bring theological beliefs into political imperatives. Indeed, we could ask the African-American community, and my distinguished colleague, Professor Rabiteau, will say more. Are you too damn religious? For that community has a long history of bringing religion into civic life. And how about that FDR? Goes on the radio and offers a prayer on D-Day, broadcast to all of America, to the world, and to our soldiers on both fronts. Presumably, we are not to have any more of that kind of thing. We could ask pro-life citizens today, many of whom are called by their faith to oppose abortion and to challenge what they take to be the abuse of state authority to sanction through law a harrowing practice. I'm assuming most of you in this room don't agree with their position, but in their protest, I would remind you that they remind us of what free speech and free exercise of religion is all about. Now, we will be likely to hear certain things from our opponents. We may be treated to a rogues gallery, a lineup of religious suspects, guilty as charged, fanatics out to steal our liberties and endanger the Republic thereby. As I read these sorts of accounts, I am stunned that America has survived. We will be told that it is only the hypervigilance of those determined to snuff out too damn much religion that has spared us. But the view that we are too damn religious does not pass critical muster I'm a professor and tempted to be professorial by citing distinguished scholars on church and state who point out that it is the vigilance of religious citizens to overextension of state power determined to quash the two damn religious that has, over the years, protected the freedoms of us all. Free exercise, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. They haven't done this alone, of course, but please, I beg you, at this late date, don't engage in the shallow exercise of pitting the non-religious who support civil liberties against those with religious commitments who allegedly do not. It flies in the face of the facts. And while we're at it, let's not traffic in the tedious pitting of faith against reason that we hear so frequently. In the long history of Christianity, as you heard from Reverend Lynn, America's dominant faith tradition, the great theologians for centuries explored the entanglement of faith and reason. Of course, you will find some who downgraded reason in the overall scheme of things, but you would be hard-pressed to find a great theologian who understood faith as nothing but a leap into irrationality. Rather, the challenge was to ask how faith and reason work together, how we could bring faith and reason to issues of our time, rather than to assume that they were polar opposites. Now, in the history of our republic, confessional pluralism and social and political pluralism go hand in hand. If you think we're too damn religious, you're likely to think we're too damn pluralistic. One of the glories of this country is turned into a liability and a danger thereby. The great French observer of the American democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, noticed something new under the political sun when he toured these United States. He took account of the way that religious conviction and associational energy and enthusiasm went hand in hand, helping to create a unique, robust civil society. Citizens of religious commitment are among the most enthusiastic supporters of a secular government. They don't want established religion, but they also understand that to support a secular government and state does not commit us to a thoroughly secularized society shorn of religious voices, symbols, activities, and commitments. We would be a greatly impoverished country were this to come to pass. So, too damn religious? Nope, just pretty damn American.
This is Intelligence Squared US. We're listening to excerpts of a debate on the motion, America is Too Damn Religious. You can download this program and hear the complete debate at our website, npr.org/intelligencesquared. Speaking in favor of the motion, here's the director of the Boissy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College, Alan Wolfe.
If the proposition before us tonight was the proposition, are Americans too damn religious, I would answer no. In fact, I'd be on that side of the table. Americans, it seems to me, could very well be much more religious than they actually are. If Americans were more religious, I believe we would have much more social justice in this country. We would have much more of an active welfare state in this country. If Americans were more religious, America would be much less religious. Our proposition is whether America is too religious, and on that question, I'm on this side of the fence, because there's a difference between Americans as individuals and America as a public space and as a public society. Now, I want to offer this proposition as the basis of my remarks. If Americans were more damn religious as opposed to America, the single greatest benefit would be that George W. Bush would never have been elected President of the United States of America. Why do I say that? Because I believe that the base of the Republican Party, sometimes called the Christian right, is much more a political movement than it is a religious movement, and that it has violated the spirit of what it means to be religious in American life, and in particular, it's violated the spirit of its own religious tradition. I'm sure that almost no one in this room knows that in 1973, when the United States Supreme Court handed down its decision in Roe v. Wade, the decision that presumably started the American culture war, the Southern Baptist Convention was fully in support of Roe v. Wade. Baptists distrusted the state. They distrusted state intervention. If the state could tell a woman what she could do with her body, it could tell a believer what he or she could do with his or her mind. By 1980s, the Southern Baptist Convention had completely changed its position, repudiated its earlier support, and become the major force besides the Catholic Church in America to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, I submit that between 1973 and 1983, God did not change his mind on the question of abortion. But Baptists did. Why did they change their minds? They changed their minds in part because they believed that America had become too decadent a society, but they also changed their minds because they saw an opportunity, and they opted for political power. And it was the direct result of this change in the Southern Baptist Convention, our largest Protestant denomination, that created the Southern Republican Party, and that eventually resulted in the election of George W. Bush with the enthusiastic support of people associated with the Southern Baptist Convention. Precisely because the Republican Party has been so successfully politically, it is incumbent upon people who oppose them to expose their use of religion for political purposes, to protect religion in America against those, the single greatest abusers of religion in America, the Republican Party, the Christian conservatives, and other people who are degrading everything meaningful, serious, and spiritual in the tradition that they claim to represent.
Speaking against the motion, America is Too Damn Religious, Albert Rabuteau, who holds the Henry W. Putnam Chair in Religion at Princeton University, he juxtaposed the contemporary American condition against many of the ethical teachings in the Bible, and he argued that America ought to be more religious. Here are some excerpts from his speech.
Good evening. A week after next, Christians, the largest religious group in the nation, we'll begin the season of Lent, a period of prayer and fasting in preparation for Easter, the holiest feast of the Christian year. In that context, I recall the voice of Isaiah speaking in the name of the Lord. Is not this the fast that I choose, to loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover them and not to hide yourself from your own flesh and blood. In a land of superabundance and obscene excess, a land of economic inequality and serious levels of intransigent poverty and homelessness, can we hear the voice of Isaiah and really claim that we in our nation are too religious? The prophet experiences the divine pathos as a fire in the bones, compelling him or her to speak and act. In 20th century America, an amazing network of religious activists carried on this prophetic tradition. Dorothy Day, co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, established houses of hospitality to feed, clothe, and shelter the indigent, based on the belief in our personal responsibility to live in solidarity with the poor. A.J. Mustey, nonviolent agitator and labor organizer, longtime director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, taught that suffering in the cause of justice releases God's presence into the stream of human history. Martin Luther King Jr., deeply rooted in the black religious tradition of suffering Christianity arising out of slavery, confronted racial and economic inequality and argued that we have to transform America from a thing-oriented to a person-oriented society, lest we succumb to the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism that continue to afflict us. If we heed the voices of these modern prophets and their ancient predecessors, we won't conclude that Americans or America are too religious. If we take heed, we will see how often we preach religion while practicing consumerism, conspicuous consumption. We will see how easy and seductive it has always been to blunt the prophetic drive of religion to radically change our lives and our society. We will see that we are not nearly religious enough.
Next, we'll hear part of the opening argument from Susan Jacoby, Program Director of the Center for Inquiry in New York. She's the final speaker in favor of the motion.
But ladies and gentlemen, let us step down from the ivory tower and the church steeple into what one of President Bush's advisors famously called the reality-based world. Down here in the reality-based world, we must first talk about the retrograde form of religion that holds one-third of Americans in thrall. This is the proportion of Americans who say that they believe every word in the Bible is literally true, not merely inspired by God, but the literal handwriting of God. One out of three. What an astounding statistic, reflecting a level of credulity that exists nowhere else in the developed world. The widespread persistence of such an antediluvian form of faith is a true affliction in American society and demonstrates, alas, that the liberty of conscience guaranteed by our Constitution also leaves us the liberty to bind ourselves with the chains of unreason. Our opponents would have you believe that those of us who consider America too bloody religious are concerned mainly with legalistic issues involving the separation of church and state. In fact, our nation's excessive religiosity affects individual lives and public policy in ways that are often matters of life and death. I could offer 2 hours worth of examples or 8 hours, but mindful of the clock, here are just two. First, consider that the United States is the only country in the Western world with a death penalty. Every study of this issue has shown that pro-death penalty views correlate closely with biblically based religious beliefs. Justice Antonin Scalia, a Roman Catholic so far to the right that he is at odds with his own church on the issue, more Catholic than the Pope, you might say, believes that since all legitimate governmental power is derived from God and God has the power of life and death, so too must governments. In a 2002 speech, Scalia quoted Paul's famous epistle to the Romans about government heads being duly designated ministers of God to avenge evil. Then Scalia noted nostalgically, and I quote, "Few doubted the morality of the death penalty in an age that believed in the divine right of kings." Well, yes, those were surely the good old days. Let us consider another very different example. The United States has the highest rate of teen pregnancy and one of the highest rates of sexually transmitted diseases among teenagers, again, in the developed world. Why? Not because American teenagers are more sexually active than any other, but because conservative religious believers have blocked sensible sex education programs and have made it as difficult as possible for teenagers to obtain contraceptives. Just recently, we learned that the man in charge of the only federal birth control program for the poor, one Dr. Eric Kerouac, spends much of his time appearing at religiously sponsored abstinence conferences, where he promotes the notion that premarital sex ruins your chances for a lasting marriage because too much sex makes you lose too much oxytocin, the hormone of pleasurable intimacy released with every orgasm. Too many orgasms, and there go your precious bodily fluids for the rest of your life. It seems that Dr. Kerouac is a disciple not of the Lord, but of General Jack D. Ripper from the movie Dr. Strangelove. This would be funny if our tax dollars were not paying this lunatic to peddle his nutty combination of right-wing faith and junk science. Now, what of the majority of Americans who are the kind of religious believers who have made room for secular knowledge in their house of faith? Martin Luther King has been very much on my mind recently, too, because it has been 40 years since he made his courageous speech denouncing the Vietnam War at the Riverside Church. Some of you were probably there. The most important points to be made here are that Dr. King, both on civil rights and the war, was speaking truth to power from outside the government, and he was speaking to a morality that transcended every religion and was in direct opposition to the religious beliefs of many Americans at the time. It is utterly nauseating to hear representatives of the religious right today cloak themselves in Dr. King's mantle when their spiritual ancestors were standing in the schoolhouse door and waving Bibles in support of segregation. So if you're going to talk about religion and all the good it can do in society, you also have to talk about religion and all the bad it can do and not pretend that bad religion is somewhere out there and has nothing to do at all with good religion. Our opponents suggest that reasonable religion does have nothing to do with extremist religion, but there are a great many more people of unreasonable faith in this country than sophisticated experts on theology would like to believe and would like you to believe. Barry Lynn has mentioned attempts to...
The final speaker against the motion, America is Too Damn Religious, is William A. Galston, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Let me tell you what this debate is not about. It's not about whether you have to be religious to be a good American. Of course you don't. Nor is it about whether you approve of the way that the most intense elements of the Republican coalition speaking in the name of religion have conducted themselves. As a lifelong activist Democrat, I sure don't. Neither do most Americans, and obviously neither do you. Nor, finally, is it about whether religion in America is without excess or without sin. Of course it isn't, for the simple reason that it is a human institution. Here, I believe, is the real question. If you believe America is too religious, you must believe that we'd be a better country if we were less religious, or maybe not religious at all. That's the proposition I'd like to contest, invoking your reason, your fair-mindedness, and your sense of history. I want to make three simple points. First of all, from the very beginning of our history, religious Americans have been at the forefront of most, if not all, of the turning points in our history. Consider the Revolutionary War, where for 10 years prior to our Declaration of Independence, Protestant ministers from the pulpit were teaching the lessons of liberty. And so when Thomas Jefferson came to draft the Declaration of Independence, he didn't have to make up a new theory. He only had to do what he said he did years later in a letter to a friend to state the plain common sense of the American mind. Or consider the anti-slavery movement, first in England and then in the United States. Religious Americans were in the lead. After the Civil War, with the rise of industrial capitalism, the teachers of the social gospel spearheaded progressive reform. They were at the forefront of concern for immigrants and for the poor. In the 1920s, the Catholic Church engaged with organized labor, and its leading intellectuals and theologians set the stage for the New Deal. In the 1950s and 1960s, the civil rights movement, of course, but the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, was fueled and sustained, among other things, by religious passions. Today, movements to fight AIDS, famine, and genocide are led by Americans of faith. Last year, I had the privilege of attending a rally on the Washington Mall against our government's inaction in Darfur. And I can tell you, if you took the religious people out of that crowd, there would hardly have been anyone left. Here's my second point. Religious Americans are among our most engaged citizens today, and their engagement strengthens our community. I'm not going to deluge you with statistics, but I can tell you this, religious Americans are far more likely than non-religious Americans to give to charitable causes, and that includes non-religious causes. Religious Americans are far more likely to volunteer than are non-religious Americans, and that includes for non-religious causes. Religious Americans are far more likely to participate in our nation's politics, to follow it closely, to attend political meetings, to join local reform groups, to contact elected officials, and even to vote than are non-religious Americans. And all of these generalizations hold true after one corrects for income, marital status, and all the other variables that social scientists like to play with. Here's my third point. Religious Americans, unlike what you have heard from our worthy opponents, are not, repeat, not a threat to our liberties. An overwhelming majority of religious Americans practice what one eminent scholar has termed a quiet faith. It is private rather than public, tolerant and inclusive, moderate rather than extreme, and above all, non-judgmental. These are not simple social science abstractions. If you don't believe me, look at the Terry Schiavo affair. Strident voices in the Republican base said, go for it. The Republican congressional leaders went for it. And then what happened? These folks were stunned to find that they had a genuine public revolt on their hands, including a revolt of a majority of religious Americans who considered what the government was doing meddling and intrusive, a violation of family privacy, an abuse of law to limit our personal freedoms. And so, my friends, to sum up, religious Americans have been at the forefront of progressive change throughout our history. They strengthen our society and our politics today, and they do not threaten, indeed, they reinforce our tradition of liberty. But every movement, secular and religious, has its extremists, those with tunnel vision and an absolute conviction of their own rectitude who will brook no compromise. Let me ask you, who among you would wish to be judged in accordance with the most extreme version of the faith or beliefs you profess? To judge fairly, you must look at the full picture, not the fringe. And if you do, I'm confident that you will conclude that America is not too damned religious after all.
Those are excerpts from an IQ Squared U.S. debate on the proposition, America is too damned religious. You can listen to the event in its entirety at our website, npr.org/intelligencesquared.
Thank you. Thank you all the panelists for your excellent talks. My name is Jerry Orstrom. I'd like to ask the panelists who oppose the motion their views on the teaching of intelligent design in the schools as an alternative to evolution.
Well, I...
William Galston.
I speak as the son of the Sterling Professor of Biology Emeritus at Yale University. So I think you can probably guess what I believe about the matter at hand. Having said that, John Stuart Mill said something that stuck with me ever since the first time I read it as an undergraduate. He who knows only his own side of the case doesn't even know that. And I was fascinated to read a review of a biography of the English botanist Alfred Russel Wallace, who was a contemporary and some of Darwin, and some believe anticipated him, and how Wallace struggled with the question of the relationship between evolution and design. You know what? I think our students might be better off if they knew something about that controversy. I'm not saying I'm in favor of the kinds of curricula that the extremists are pushing, but if you're asking me in principle, would it be good for our students to know that there is a history of debate on this issue, and people who are by no means manifestly foolish have taken various points of view? No, I don't think they would be worse off.
Barry Lynn, did you want to respond to that?
Bill, I think this is a good example of what we're talking about tonight. The truth is that in two major recent studies, high school biology teachers said that they spent, quote, little or no time discussing evolution. Why do they do that? Because they are afraid of stirring up community distaste for what they're doing in those public schools. So in some other alternate universe where we would have the time to spend enormous amounts of time talking about evolution and then perhaps discussing this controversy, you might be making a very important point. But we are now facing a dumbing down of science so terrible in this country that biology teachers, without any statutes or passage of any goofy resolutions from school boards, are simply afraid to teach the truth, the scientific truth, as they know it to be true. And that's the climate of religious efforts to move city councils, state legislatures, state boards of education in the direction of biblical literalism instead of scientific truth, without even understanding that there's a difference between the two disciplines. That's the real world. that Susan was talking about. That's what we find when we litigate these cases, as we did with the ACLU of Pennsylvania up in Dover, Pennsylvania.
I have to say I'm a little tired of this real-world, illusory world distinction, as if those of us over here are somehow living in an alternate universe, where, in fact, certain kinds of discussions can go forward and be had, and it's to the benefit of everyone. That's simply not the case. I think that we understand very well the kinds of pressures that can be brought to bear, given the way in which America has organized its schools. We've never had total monolithic control of the schools. We have school districts with a lot of independence. That means you're going to get variety from place to place. If this process of dumbing down were as systematic as Mr. Lynn suggests, it makes our continuing astonishing sort of scientific progress and the fact that people come from all over the world to study science here a bit perplexing. Now, having said that, let me just indicate that if you look at the kinds of textbooks that are used, which I did, but maybe I was doing that in an alternate universe, that are used to teach science in our high schools and are the most widely adopted textbooks, you see that evolution, in fact, is covered. But it is also important not to become, it seems to me, if we're worried about fundamentalism, there is a kind of Darwinian fundamentalism that, in fact, will brook no debate and no opposition. And the truth of the matter is, if you know anything about this field at all, is that there's a tremendous amount of debate internal to it. And scientists who see themselves as evolutionists who strenuously reject Darwin's classical theory and so forth. So I think students can handle these kinds of debates, both within science and between the scientists and those with an alternate account, although I should say that a lot of the intelligence design people, including a very distinguished scientist named Sir John Polkinghorne, do support some notion of intelligent design. So it's not just a bunch of wackos out there who want to dumb everything down, who think this debate should go forward.
Susan.
Yes, I would just like to say that Dr. Elstein's comment is typical of this kind of argument. She is suggesting that there is actually debate about evolution versus intelligent design. There is, of course, much debate within the scientific community about many of the particulars of evolution. There is no debate at all in the scientific community about intelligent design on the one hand versus evolution on the other. Furthermore, what Dr. Galston said, certainly intelligent design would be an interesting thing to have in a college course on the history of pseudoscience and religion. That would be good. But to include it in a high school biology class would be to include, for example, the theory of that vortexes were responsible for the Earth turning on its axis. That is not a debate. It's putting nonsense in the same classroom as science, period.
Could I have a question from this side of the auditorium, please?
My name is Susan Harrington, and what I'm a little bit concerned about this evening is that the question for me is not, are Americans too religious? That's really of no interest to me. More important to me is the American government too religious? Are the American schools too religious? Is the American medical society too religious or affected by religion?
Panelists? Barry Lynn?
I think Susan was addressing that issue as Alan and I were also, that our concern is the way in which religion has played off government and played off politics in these negative ways. The fact that Franklin Delano Roosevelt said a prayer on D-Day over the radio, I'm not too troubled about. What I am troubled about is George W. Bush appears to have a prayer for every day from A Day to Z Day, and he's happy to share it with us at all times. His ideology, shared by many of those third of Americans who are biblical literalists, has a tremendous negative effect on the way we can do science, the very things we can study in medicine and science. So while some are coming to America to study, you're right, Gene, it's also true that because of our absurd policies, for example, on stem cell research, we are losing some of the top scientists in this country, East and West, to other nations.
Does anyone, Bill?
I really have to protest with a smile. One of the pieces of my biography is that I was in the Clinton White House for 2.5 years as his deputy director for domestic policy. I have gone down with the good ship Al Gore twice. I did not come here, I thought, for a debate about George Bush and the Bush administration. I really do yield to no one in my opposition to this administration. But to reason from the follies and excesses of this administration to conclusions about America just strikes me as a syllogism with a missing middle.
The moderator will take charge. Bill, are you finished with your remarks? Because I'd like Ellen, who made the distinction between Americans and America, respond, if that's all right.
I think I've made my point.
I'm a great admirer of all your work with Al Gore and Bill Clinton, but look, I'm the one who brought George W. Bush into this debate, and how could you not on this particular subject? We have seen in the last 6 years really a radical transformation in my opinion, the manipulation of a politico-religious, pseudo-religious movement to serve secular ends, but to cover it with religious language, because it is widely understood in this country, given its religiosity, that it's perfectly appropriate to argue about politics, but it's not appropriate to argue about religion, as Susan Jacoby said. Once you say you're religious, then we're all supposed to say, oh, I don't know, my goodness, of course I respect everything you say. It seems to me a violation of both the principles of liberal democratic debate, but even more importantly, a violation of the fundamental Christian idea of rendering under Caesar what is Caesar's and rendering to God what is God's. For politicians, George W. Bush and the Republican Party, to try to impose undemocratically a radical agenda on the United States, bad enough, and then to cover it in religious language as a way of immunizing themselves from criticism, because we all know that this is a particularly thin-skinned administration that doesn't want the public to question what it does. And what a better way to do that than to say or to claim that when people disagree with them, that's religious bigotry, that's religious prejudice, and so on. So that's why George W. Bush is here.
There was a panel.
Gene Elstein.
Go ahead. Yeah.
There was a panel a couple of years ago at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Religion. About 7,000 people show up to this thing. And it had to do with looking at the explicit religious references and so on in the speeches of President Clinton and George Bush. And it turned out that Bill Clinton referenced scripture more frequently than Bush did. And as Bill Galston likes to say, it's because he knows it better. But at any rate, it's the notion... the political agenda that seems to be going on is because one opposes certain policies, one therefore has to oppose the fact that those promulgating these policies have strong religious beliefs. But if you favor the policies, then presumably the religious references, the use of scripture and so on, is something to good ends. And I think that if we want to blame, Barry Lynn mentioned the faith-based initiative, I think the person responsible is right here. I mean, this was a Clinton administration initiative. So I think there's been a lot of history being rewritten here about how these things work. And I also think, Alan, you're not giving the American people enough credit to sort out the use and abuse of religion in the public sphere. I mean, if indeed the Bush administration were so diabolically clever, as you seem to claim it is, why aren't his ratings up at 80%? People have a capacity to think critically about this. Give people some credit.
Susan Jacoby.
The reason George W. Bush's ratings are down is because you can't keep the reality-based world away forever. This is just call this the revenge of the reality-based world.
I'd like to throw in a question myself, because despite the sparks we've seen in recent moments, I detected a distressing amount of agreement underlying many of the debaters' presentations tonight. Namely, there's agreement about all kinds of bad forms of religion. There certainly was not endorsements of certain kinds of use of government and legislative fiat for religious purposes. But I'm still not certain about the question which in some ways Bill Galston posed. If the price of getting rid of the forms of religion that bothers us or the uses of religion in conjunction with state power were to make Americans somehow or other less religious generally, pray less, read scripture less, pay less attention to their religious leaders, is that the price that we think would be worth paying? And I thought Susan answered that to some extent directly in her remarks.
No,
but I don't have other people. I'd like to have other people's responses.
I didn't say it. First of all, I think that's a false choice. I don't think that the price we pay in not letting government be as involved with religion as it is in making Americans less religious at all. In Europe, there is, in fact, much more official church-state entanglement than there has been here all along. And yet Europe is indeed much more secular than it is here, and probably that is the reason. So I cannot imagine why anyone would think that whatever we do about church and state will make Americans personally less religious. Not that I care. I think less religion would be better altogether. Well, but I don't see why it would affect Americans' personal religion.
I was Alan Wolf. Sure this issue would arise, and that's why I wanted to be on this side, to point out to the audience that we on this side can disagree with each other. On the question of whether Americans are too damn religious and still completely agree on the question of whether America is too damn religious, that distinction, it just strikes me as enormously important. I am not Sam Harris. I am not Richard Dawkins. I do not object to religion. I object to public religion, the use and deliberate manipulation of religion. That, it seems to me, is the problem. So, Peter, my answer to your question is, we're not here to address the question you raise. The question of whether Americans are not religious enough or too religious is just not simply on the table. It's not what we're about. You want to have Richard Dawkins debate John Polkinghorne or something like that, then have that debate. But that's not our debate.
Is it? Jean Elstein.
Alan, public religion refers not just to the people that you don't like misusing religion as you understand it. It refers quite specifically to the kinds of movements and efforts that our side has identified. That precisely involves bringing religion into the public square as a form of public religion. I think that your understanding of religion is of a kind of quiet, contemplative sort, where it's all about my own orientation. But as we well know, historically, various religious traditions have strong histories of different forms of social engagement. The question is, what does that engagement look like? What does it involve? And none of the folks that we talked about, none of the efforts we talked about, called for anything like establishing a faith, anything like something like quasi-establishment, but certainly believed that there had to be this strong public witness and public presence. That's what America historically has very much been about. And that's one of the fruits, and here I think might be the one point where I agree with Susan, the fruits of free exercise. You precisely have the kind of hollowing out of the religious traditions in Europe because of that history of church state, which I think destroys religion over a long time when you've got established religion. We don't have that. We've never had that.
But we have people who want it. That's
no,
the point.
No, they
I
don't.
Couldn't agree with you more
they don't
than,
want a, they don't want an established religion. They have too strong a stake in free exercise.
For the majority. Here's what we're going to do at this point.
We've come to the end of our radio program. To hear the concluding statements and the full unedited version of this live debate, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. While you're there, you can also hear other debates in the Intelligence Squared series. The audience was polled a second time at the end of the evening on the resolution, America is too damn religious. Those in favor of the proposition carried the day. The audience voted 70% for the motion. That was up 3 percentage points. And still, 24% against, same as before the debate. 6% said they didn't know. The Intelligence Squared U.S. debate series is an initiative of the Rosenkranz Foundation. Chairman Robert Rosenkranz, executive producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series or to find out how you can get tickets to attend future live events, visit www.iq2us.org. That's www.iq2us.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared US is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC New York Public Radio. Producer Rob Christensen. Senior producer Ellen Horn. Production assistant Scott Goldberg. The recording was engineered by Edward Haber, Damon Whittemore, and Marlon Barry. Intelligence Squared US is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.